Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past. Alison Steggart won HNSA's 2020 Elizabeth Jane Corbett Mentorship for Young Adult Fiction. The prize, established in honour of Elizabeth Jane Corbett, allows a previously unpublished author who received mentorship. Well, it paid off in spades for Alison. With the novel, Her Majesty's League of Remarkable Young Ladies, the details of which we'll hear about in this podcast. Alison, welcome to Imagining the Past.
Morning. Happy to be here.
So when did you first start writing?
I started writing probably in about 2010, and then decided about that time that's what I wanted to write for children. I suppose before that I'd written short stories and whatnot for a couple years before that.
What prompted you to start writing? Why did you start writing?
It's always been a strength, you know. Some people call on me to write things, and it's always been a dream back there to write stories for kids. And I finally got to a point in my life where I was like, if I don't do this now, I'm going to miss out. I had waited for my kids to grow up and, you know, not need me as much. And then once they were all fully grown, I was like, okay, it's my time to do this.
Okay, and what was the first idea you had for this novel, and how many other novels have you written?
I've written, I think we're up to about six. And none of them have gotten anywhere, but they were a good learning ground, and I have hopes for a couple of them. So with this one, what happened was I was working as a school counselor for over a decade, and in a school setting, they have professional development for the whole staff, and sometimes it pertained to my work, and sometimes it didn't. And one day they had a professional development about STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. And I was listening in on this. It really didn't affect my work at all, but it was interesting. And one of the things that they mentioned was that there is a confidence gap between girls and boys in their abilities to do subjects of STEM. And I thought that was really interesting. What it means is that particularly in Australia, America, UK, because of this confidence lack, girls tend not to pursue STEM careers, you know. And I thought that was sad, but it also made me immediately remember how when I was in junior school, I loved science and I was kind of good at math, but there was a time when something changed and I stopped believing I had any ability in that, and I thought that was interesting. So I continued to listen in this professional development, and one of the things they said was that a part of the problem was a lack of role models, and that there are subtle kind of societal influences that shape the way girls view themselves regarding these areas. And I thought, you know, there's stereotypes. So, for example, science books might only have pictures of male scientists, or, you know, people talk about male engineers and whatnot. And I thought, you know, girls are good at these things. I wonder what I could do as a writer. And then they said something about how stereotypes and cultural norms kind of dampen girls' interests. And I thought, I could write a book, you know, that is a, you know, gives girls a role model and an inspiration and kind of encourages them in their interest of these subjects. And so I started playing with that idea. And originally I had a girl who wanted to build bridges, and her name was Brigitte. So that's where it started. And it stayed kind of just in the notebook stage for a couple of years. And then one day I had the idea of an inventor, because I realized you can't carry a bridge around. I wanted her to have something that was portable, you know? And so then I thought, okay, how do I make this really interesting and give this girl some real challenges? And so I put her in a society where girls were not allowed to pursue these fields. And of course that puts us into the 19th century. And I realized, oh, I've got a great idea here. And then, you know, it just gradually developed over a while into an inventor of gadgets of espionage. And in the process of all of that, I discovered things like chatelaines. And a chatelaine, I better explain, is a 19th century accessory. Actually, they wore them before the 19th century, but it's a women's fashion accessory that clips onto the waistband. It's a beautiful brooch, and it has chains, and then on the ends of the chains there are equipages like scissors or change purse or keys, smelling salts, that type of thing. And so I turned the chatelaine into a tool of espionage, and then I had my story. So that's kind of the, you know, the way it's shaped. And that process right there took about 4 years.
What age group is the novel aimed at?
It's aimed at 9 to 14.
Yeah. And what kind of drew you to CYA rather than adult fiction?
That's such an easy question to answer. It's the community. The Kidlit community is so welcoming and so encouraging, and just, you know, they build everybody up, they draw everybody in, they support each other. You know, I just found it such a welcoming place to be. Whereas my attempts to enter into the adult world, I kind of couldn't find my way in, couldn't find my tribe. But as soon as I started doing the children's thing, I immediately found like-minded people.
So you had written adult fiction prior?
Yeah, just the short stories and that kind of thing. I've never a large piece.
Right.
And I've recently reread some of the short stories and I thought, hey, they're actually not that bad.
That's a nice sensation.
Yeah.
So were there dangers around using people like Queen Victoria and speculating about them?
Yes. I think with Queen Victoria, there's always going to be somebody who knows more than you do, you know. And I did do a lot of research, but I think the danger is with the stereotypes and the things that people hold true that might not be true. And if you might go, I know that that's not a fact. But if you wrestle with that, there'll be people who go, but it is true, you know? And, you know, I don't want to get into that. But an example would be, you know, she famously said, we are not amused. And she claims she never said that. And so the battle rages. Did she or didn't she say that? And so what did I do with that? I played with it. And then in the, you know, in school visits and whatnot, I make sure I tell kids, she may not have said that, but it's fun to think that she did say it.
Well, I think it's the same with a lot of things, like, you know, let the meat take. Was that actually ever said?
Right, exactly. And was it actually Marie Antoinette? You know, apparently it's been attributed to other people as well. So, yeah, so it's fun. But I think Queen Victoria is such a curious character. There's so much to do with her. You know, she's just so fascinating. She looks so sour, and you know, there's just so much to do. But when you read about her, she actually had a, you know, a great big laugh, and she was, you know, had a sense of humor. She's very smart. Right. You know, she spoke numerous languages. She learned Hindustani as an older woman. My gosh, you know, she was very determined, and so she's a lot more complex than just some old depressed widow that, you know, a lot of people want to write her off as.
I guess with such a long public life,
yeah,
you know, that there's so many different periods through that life as well.
Absolutely.
And so many different happenings in that life that it's open to a lot of interpretation.
Yeah, and in fact, that's actually was one of the tricky things to pick was when do I set this? But in my case, you know, I had a long, you know, she had a long, long reign, and so I could have picked any time. I actually, one of my previous novels was set in 1855, and so a lot of my Victorian research happened around that. But in my case, the Paris World Fair was what said it. I needed that as my end point. And originally, it was at the Paris 1899 World Fair. And the book was called Winifred Weatherby Saves the Century, which is a great title. Sorry, it's just great. and that was the original title. But then I discovered this character, who's Stella Davies. We can talk about her in a bit. And I wanted to include her, but the only way I could do it and keep the time period right was to move the story back in history. And fortunately, there was a 1889 Paris World Fair as well. And that was the one when the Eiffel Tower was built. And so it was brilliant. And it worked out well.
So what type of research did you do? And were there some real standout moments while you were doing it?
Yes, it's interesting. Like I said, I a lot of my reading and Victorian research happened early in the noughties when I was writing The Temple of Lost Time, which was it was in 1859. So I did a lot of research back then. But that was fun. But when I decided that this book was going to get written, it was 2019, and I was like, this is the year when I'm going to write this book. It filled notebooks, and I had so many ideas, and I just knew it was ripe. So this was on like New Year's Eve of 2019, and I'm like, this is the year I write that book. And we're going to go to the UK and do a study tour and, you know, a research trip, and it's going to be great. And I've started to plan all of that. And guess what happened in 2020? We had a pandemic. Shut all of that down. And so this trip to the UK that I had been looking forward to, you know, ever since I started this project, was just wiped out. But I was like, no, I'm still writing this book this year. And so I ended up having to do a lot of the nitty-gritty research with Google and Google Maps. But I mean, I had some incredible serendipitous moments doing that. Like there's, if you've read the book, you know, there's a scene where Winnie is trapped in a coal cellar and in a house in Chelsea. And I was like, but did that house actually have a coal chute? And I don't know, for some reason, I just needed to know that it did. And so I used Google Earth to zoom down to street level and check the pavement. And there was, in fact, a coal chute in front of the house where I placed Winifred. And so I felt so much better knowing that it was actually accurate. You know, I mean, and that's the kind of little detail that you'd be able to do if you were on the ground. Yeah. So you know, it was fun. And then the other thing I did was I shifted from buildings that people knew well that I couldn't walk into and get my bearings. I changed it to Holland House, which was destroyed in World War II. So nobody can argue with me if I got something wrong on the layout. I did use like ground plans, you know, floor plans for the the ball that takes place in that building. But so I just made some decisions to try to keep it as correct as possible. That, you know, the research was fun and interesting, but it wasn't the research trip that I had dreamed of.
Do you feel, you've obviously achieved a lot by using modern mechanisms, but I wonder, do you feel a sense of lack? Did you feel that lack of not being able to actually walk where you were writing about?
Absolutely. I very much am a very tactile and sensate person, you know, and so the way sound fills a room tells me a lot about a space and how people will feel in that. And I really did feel sad to miss out on that. But in a lot of ways, it you know, I just tried to avoid situations where that was going to be extremely important. And then otherwise, and like, I was like, well, maybe I can find a Victorian building here in Australia, you know, and get an idea of the foyer. And then in Brisbane, there's the museum building. And so I felt like the foyer in there would give me a kind of sense of the grandeur. I'm not sure it did, but I found some incredible paintings and pictures, you know, to give me a sense of the space. I used art a lot.
Yeah, it's true about the buildings here that I always, I don't know if you know Central Station in Sydney, but it's got these beautiful sandstone archways that go over Edie Avenue. And I remember when I first moved to Sydney thinking there should be, you know, Victorian women in great bustled dresses walking around the bases of them, because they, it just seemed like from another age completely.
It's true. I was only at the beginning of last month, I was under that space that you are talking about. And even that's what, there's like a park across the street. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember thinking the same thing. Oh, this, you know, if it weren't so bustly and noisy and they have those zoomy, what do you call
it? The trams.
Is it the tram or the, that's going past, but yeah. Yeah. Listen.
So I'm just wondering, when you're writing, probably more when you're revising it, do you think about the gender of your reader? Because I'm just wondering how young male readers would find your novel, and have you had any feedback on that?
I have. I do think of the gender of the readers. I mean, in this instance, this book was about inspiring young girls, you know. But I put a character in there, Clancy, to hopefully create somebody that boy readers could, you know, track with and really enjoy. I don't think a lot of boys will pick this book up by themselves, you know. I have a friend who's a teacher librarian, and she said to me, if you have the word girl or ladies or any female name in the title, boys are not going to read it. And that, you know, is a brutal truth, which is sad, because I'd really like boys to, you know, see girls doing this kind of thing and so that they can encourage them too, you know. But when I do school visits, I make sure that I talk a lot about Clancy, so that it's not just about, you know, pushing the, you know, a girl's education agenda or anything like that. And to make, you know, make them realize there is actually something fun in here that you would enjoy.
I mean, Clancy doesn't have a huge role, and he also doesn't have the natural agency that the girls have. You know, from a quite impoverished background, really, isn't he?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But he's very brave and very loyal. And I would like to think, if I ever get to write a sequel, that Clancy will have a bigger role and maybe even be part of the team.
Yeah, I understand what you were doing with empowering the young girls with agency and abilities and things, but I just kind of wonder sometimes if these kind of rewrites of history do kind of push a bit far over into representing something that just kind of really wasn't. And so I'm just kind of then worried about the ramifications of that. For example, you know, if a young girl read this novel and was inspired by it, and then years later hears about the suffragette movement, you'd be like, why did you need the suffragette movement? You know, women in Victorian times had great agency. You know, I mean, you know, there's obviously levels of confusion, but it just kind of struck me it was slightly misleading.
That's always a danger. You know, I guess you have so much room in a story to, and you got to decide what you're going to focus on. But like when I go to school visits, we often, you know, I'll do a talk about the ways that women were actually constrained and how they couldn't even own property. You know, anything that they did, if they were a writer, the book was, you know, the money that they earned was often their husband's. You know, it's it is a very good point.
Yeah. Also, I kind of was a bit triggered in a way. I kind of felt like I needed trigger warnings because I just kind of felt like at school, I remember there were these bunch of girls who were so bright and so encouraged with humanities. And, you know, one of them has now gone on to earn more money than God writing horoscopes in the UK. Another one, Mary Lou Stevens, has published her third novel, is just about to come out. Whereas I felt like as a boy, I was steered into science and that was the only thing that I was going to be able to do. So I kind of felt, you know, the reverse situation is true as well. Like you're saying that young girls were not encouraged to do STEM subjects, but, you know, were boys encouraged to do humanities? In my case, it was really frowned on.
Yeah. It's interesting. I read this study recently while I was preparing for this, and it talked about how boys and girls in schools generally have similar scores in maths and that type of thing, but in the arts, girls excel, and so they tend to go to those subjects where they feel, you know, better and feel, you know, like they're going to, and then they get encouraged in those directions, and so. So there's something that we have to shift in the education system where, you know, the encouragement isn't unnaturally skewed, you know. It is tricky, isn't it?
So just maybe we could talk a little bit about your craft. How is your writing process? You know, do you enjoy a first draft, or does it take a long while? And then once you've got that done, do you enjoy editing that?
Yeah, usually before I begin a draft, this is the way I want to work. It doesn't always happen that way with publishers, but I like to spend a long time, you know, years of just incubating an idea and letting it kind of evolve. And when that happens, and I do the draft, I can do the draft very quickly, the first draft very quickly, and I can be extremely focused. Like I can start something and have it finished in 3 months. It's not going to be very good, but, you know, at least it's done. And then and you've got something to work with. And
so how many words would that first draft be?
First one of this one was 80,000, around there.
That's quite a solid chunk.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, and then you there's a lot of, you know, stuff to skim off of that and, you know, to actually find what you need to have and not have. And
So then once you've got that draft down, do you enjoy editing?
Yes, I enjoy the first round of editing, and then each subsequent round I enjoy less. Until by the end of it, I'm like, so I just am a nervous wreck. You know, I just can't wait to not look at it anymore. And yeah. So I don't know. I think I enjoy drafting more than I enjoy editing. I do enjoy the editing process, but Yeah, so much of the creativity happens before any of the writing happens, though. So that's probably the part I like the best, you know, just having complete freedom with an idea.
Mm. And what do you do during that period of time? Do you take notes, or do you just let it literally ferment in your brain, or do you try and write things down?
It usually starts with a character, and I might have a go at writing a first chapter or something like that, just to allow see if a voice emerges. And with Winifred, this was the first time that ever happened. I wrote the first chapter, and as soon as she stepped onto the page, she took over, and it was so exciting. And so I basically pantsed that, which I had never done before. And it was really, really great. And I wish I knew exactly what magic made that happen so I could do it again, you know, every time. But sometimes it's just trial and error and not forcing it. I think that's the other thing, is not forcing it.
I think we all want a dose of that.
Yeah.
So you had quite an interesting pathway to publication. What was winning the 2021 Times Chicken House Prize for an unpublished manuscript? How was that?
That was so exciting. I had entered that maybe two or three times before and never gotten anywhere. And they were kind of a dream publisher. I liked their books. I liked their authors. And I liked the kind of origin story of that publisher. Do you know the story behind that?
No.
So Chicken House is run by a man named Barry Cunningham. And the mission of Chicken House is to discover new talent. And I suppose the Chicken House thing is about incubation or something like that. I don't know. But Barry Cunningham was the editor, I think he was at Penn Macmillan at the time, who gave Harry Potter a shot. And so he's the one who signed J.K. Rowling for that book, and he discovered that new talent there. And so obviously that book and that series set him up, and so he set up Chicken House, and then every year with the Times did a international competition where people send in their full manuscripts for middle grade or YA, and you get picked. And so yeah, I was long listed for the YA version of my book, which I wrote with Dr. Wendy Dunn through the mentorship with the Historical Novel Society. And so it was so exciting when that happened. And then what happened was that year they had two prizes. They had their normal one. They often do have two, but this year there was one for a STEM manuscript. So it was the Times Chicken House IET 150 prize. And the IET is the Institution of Engineering Technology. And they were having their 150th anniversary. And the board director that year was a woman engineer, and her idea to celebrate was to sponsor a book that featured a young woman in a STEM.
It was really the right place in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. So that year when I saw that, I was like, oh, my book kind of really fits that one. I was going to put it in the other one. And I was like, it kind of fits in that one. And so it really, you know, the timing really worked out well.
So you mentioned the HNSA Elizabeth Jane Corbett mentorship. I'm just wondering, how was that mentorship and what kind of things came out of that?
It was a brilliant mentorship. You know, it gave me such confidence early in the process of this, you know, just a boost of, you know, like I said, Winifred walked onto the page and I felt like I had something special with her. But then when I was granted that mentorship, I was like, I think, you know, it just gave me this confidence of, yeah, maybe she is something special. Maybe I've finally found my way. And then to get to work with someone like Dr. Wendy Dunn was just brilliant. She was so helpful. You know, I spent a lot of time kind of like polishing it up and trying to get the story tight before I gave it to her, so that we didn't waste time with, you know, with stupid stuff. But she was great. You know, she just gave me excellent feedback and some suggestions, and really helped me with some historical techniques and things that I needed to, you know, improve on. And, you know, just like making sure my language wasn't anachronistic. And I mean, I had an awareness of it before, but after that, it really helped me realize where, you know, like the kind of mistakes I was making. And so it was brilliant. It was a very, very worthwhile opportunity.
And do you feel like having won that and been through that process, did that alter the reception for the manuscript from the industry when you started approaching or doing that side of it?
I think so, because after I finished with Wendy, I put it in the CYA conference competition, and it won the YA first place in the YA competition in that year too. And so it wouldn't have done that without you know, the polishing that I did with Wendy. And so it was definitely made a big help. And then shortly after that, you know, so in that process, I won the prize, which was a consultation with an editor from HarperCollins in Australia. And there was some interest there, and you know, we were talking back and forth, and I also had an Australian agent who was interested in it. And but I was like, I had entered it in the Chicken House Prize, and I thought, I really want to see what's going to happen with that, because it's, you know, that would put it into a bigger playing field. And so it was very scary, but I had to make a lot of I had to pull back on a lot of opportunities, and just kind of see if I could put it in a holding pattern while I waited to see what happened with Chicken House. And then when I was longlisted, I was like, oh, phew. I hadn't, you know, I was so afraid I'd made the wrong decision. But when it got longlisted, I thought, okay, it's all right. We're all right. We're, you know, might not win, but at least, you know, we're still good. And I, you know, if I needed to, I could possibly go back.
So by the time Chicken House became involved, you'd done a remarkable amount of work on Her Majesty's League of Remarkable Young Ladies. That must have made their job pretty easy.
Well, you'd think so. But what ended up happening was they read it and felt that my voice was more suited to a middle grade book. And they asked me to consider, they're very polite and very willing to work with me, but asked me to consider if I would re-jiggy it to become a middle grade book. And I didn't mind that suggestion, because the original idea had been for a middle grade book. But it was interesting. I said, yes, I'd be happy to rewrite it as a middle grade book. And they said, well, you'll have to change some things. Some of the scenes are not appropriate for young children. I said, yeah, that's fine. We can do that. And then Barry said to me, you're also going to have to make it better, because right now it's boring.
Goodness.
And this is on a video conference. This is on a video conference. And I was like, ouch, on the inside. But I went away and thought about it. And the bits that he felt were boring were actually historical content that I found fascinating. It was, you know, Queen Victoria's grandchildren, and she was marrying them off together, and they were objecting. And I found that fascinating, and I had worked it into the story. But I realized that middle grade readers are not going to find that very interesting at all. So I had to start it over. And I had to come up with a more middle grade friendly villain. I had to, you know, just change things. So it actually was a substantial rewrite, to the point of, I would say, more than 85% brand new material that I worked on with the editor. So it was a very significant rewrite. And, It was fun. But I added a new girl to the team, and I added I changed the dogs from Italian greyhounds to pugs, and because I thought pugs added a comic element that the Italian greyhounds weren't. And I added the rhyme at the beginning as a kind of thematic spine through the story. It's a magpie rhyme, one for sorrow, two for joy. It's very well known in Europe, but not as well known in Australia, I think. But I have had children here in Australia tell me that they're familiar with the rhyme as well.
Right.
So yes, that was you would think that by the time Chicken House got their hands on it, that it would have been a simple thing, but it wasn't at all.
So we're just coming up to the next round of applications for the Elizabeth Jane Corbett mentorship. So I'm just wondering what you would suggest to people to make their applications really stand out. What kind of things do you think they can do?
I think obviously make the submission as good as possible, and have your manuscript as tight as possible, so that when you're actually getting to work with Wendy, you have you can draw on her expertise for the really important stuff, and check the voice of your character. I really think that that's the thing that grabs people's attention. And I've had so many people say this to me since, that when they're looking at manuscripts, story is, plot is important and all of that, but the thing that draws the judges or the editors or the agents in is a strong voice. And so, yeah, I would say, try to make that stand out.
And just to finish up today, what are you working on now? What's next?
Now I am working on a contemporary action adventure with elements of horror for middle grade readers. It's called Ernestine Creed and the London Mummy Uprising. And
Goodness.
it's always lots of fun. It deals a little bit with colonialism and British museums and that mummies and fun stuff. So it's I'm having a lot of fun, and maybe this time I will get to have my research trip.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today. It was fun to talk to you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and good luck to those who apply for the mentorship.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.